the headlines, multiple blasts hit densely populated parts of the Afghan capital, Kabul, leaving 8 people dead and over 30 others injured. Fresh two-week restrictions come into force across Iran as part of measures to stem the spread of the new coronavirus. And the U.S. cities face unprecedented demand for food aid amid new lockdowns put in place to contain the coronavirus. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. Multiple blasts hit the Afghan capital, Kabul, killing at least 8 and injuring 31 others. The Interior Ministry says at least 23 rockets hit the city, targeting several areas in its northern and central parts. The Iranian embassy said a rocket also landed in its precinct, but caused no casualties. The blast followed 2 explosions in the city. The violence comes ahead of a meeting between the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and negotiators from the Taliban and the Afghan government in Qatar. An inter-Afghan peace talk was launched in September, but it has made little progress amid differences in some basic issues. The talks are part of an earlier peace agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban, under which the militant group committed to reduce violence. However, the violence has continued in recent months. Kabul correspondent Amin Alami says the recent surge in violence has claimed more than 2,000 lives so far.
None of terrorist groups, including Daesh and Taliban, have not claimed responsibility for these twin security incidents here in Kabul. Since the beginning of the intra-Afghan talks almost 2 months ago between the Taliban and the Afghan government, the Taliban militant group has expanded its attacks and killed over 2,000 Afghan civilians and injured more others. This is according to Afghanistan's Interior Ministry as well as Afghanistan's Defense Ministry.
The UN Secretary General has warned that war-ravaged Yemen faces the imminent danger of the worst famine the world has not seen for decades. During our news review program, we discussed the issue. Let's take a look.
UN Secretary General has warned war-ravaged Yemen is facing imminent danger of the worst famine the world has seen in decades. In a statement, Antonio Guterres said millions of lives could be lost if no immediate action is taken. The UN has already described Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with 80% of the people there in need of help. Saudi Arabia launched a devastating war on Yemen early 2015. Months after the beginning of that war, Riyadh placed a strict land, aerial, and naval blockade on the country. Restrictions have deprived millions of Yemenis of much-needed food and fuel. The conflict has taken a heavy toll also on the country's infrastructure, destroying hospitals, schools, and factories. And joining us now for this news review is Abdul Latif Al-Washali from Sana'a and Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist, joining us from Toronto, Canada. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program here. I guess we'll start there in Sana'a with our correspondent, Abdul Latif. Give us the latest out of Yemen. How are things looking today?
It's so strange and of irony that the world is celebrating today the World's Children's Day, and almost 12 million children in Yemen are suffering from not getting enough food and suffering from famine. The immediate action, the people in Yemen are really wondering, what is the immediate action that UN is need to take? It's to lift the blockade and the siege, which has been forced on the Yemenis for years till now. We don't need much aid assistance. We don't need much aid help from other countries and the world community. We need the blockade to be lifted, and the people of Yemen will get the enough aid, food, medicine, and fuel, and all the vital things for the life of a human being.
Right, but Abdul Latif, what are things looking like in the last 8 months after this pandemic came into Yemeni soil?
The health system is already collapsing from the siege, from the war. The coalition of Saudi Arabia and the militias have been targeting the health facilities, hospitals, and all the other things. We don't have enough even tests for coronavirus or COVID-19 to know if the virus is really spreading among people. We don't have the tests. We don't have any health infrastructure, which has been already collapsed, as I said before, from the war phase forced on Yemenis.
And Eric, you know what? Abdul Latif makes a good point there. I mean, we know that when Donald Trump is in office, we heard Democrats, you know, lambasting him and condemning his policies on Yemen, saying it's outrageous. They're selling too many arms to the Saudis. They're using them on women and children in Yemen. But guess what? Guess who, you know, started supporting Riyadh in this onslaught? It was the Obama administration. So do you have any optimism when it comes to come January 20th? Do you feel like from that point forward, Yemenis might catch a break coming out of Washington or no?
Well, I remember that period, the Arab Spring. I was in Cairo at Al-Ahram and covering that and looking at it. And it was such a divided situation. Yemen has been, since then, it's been basically at war with itself. And I don't think the U.S. was really instrumental in making it. It was always divided, tribal, and also there's the old communist South versus the North, and there's the monarchy. It's a very, very complex situation. So I don't think Biden's going to make it worse. Trump, when he goes in, he just looks for a quick deal, you know, some GARMs, just pat the dictator on the back and move on. But I don't think Biden is that. I think we'll have at least some more intelligent intelligence coming out of the White House. And I think already the Democrats voted many times to stop funding the war in Yemen. And Trump vetoed that, I think, five times. So I think that will be a very early on policy of Biden, stop the war in Yemen and also make up with Iran to some extent to re-enter. So I think that it's going to be a very big change. But Trump is, as I said, he's creating a salted earth strategy. He's going to leave behind such a mess that almost it would be like when Bush finished. Sure. And it took 8 years to try and undo some of his mess. So we're faced with the same thing all over again with Trump.
But you don't make things tough. You know, throughout this pandemic, the U.S. has taken a huge financial blow. And, you know, the Saudis are a cash cow when it comes to purchasing U.S. arms and basically bringing in billions of dollars to the U.S. Arms industry.
I think that there's enough momentum in the U.S. There's enough within the Democratic Party to stop the nonsense in Yemen and Iran. I think that's a clear positive. And let's just hold on and see that Trump doesn't destroy the whole world.
There's hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of people that are hoping you're right on that. Eric, stay safe, both of you. Thank you for joining us on the program here. Abdul Latif Al Washali joining us from Sana'a, and Mr. Eric Wahlberg joining us out of Toronto, Canada. And that's a wrap for this segment, everyone, of Europe News Review. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. Yemen's health officials say the number of cancer cases has been on the rise over the past years due to the use of banned weapons by the Saudi coalition in its war on the impoverished nation.
For the first time in Yemen, capital Sana'a hosted the first scientific conference on cancerous diseases with a focus on gynecological cancers, attended by a large number of specialized doctors and academics under the sponsorship of the Yemeni Health Ministry.
We thought about enhancing the role of person, individual roles, families, communities, to be like sharing us our concern about their health by educating them, by raising awareness about the signs and symptoms of cancers.
Since 2015, the number of cancer cases in Yemen has increased rapidly. According to the Undersecretary of the Health Ministry, Ali Jahaf, he says this is due to the prohibited arms used by the U.S.-Saudi coalition over the past years.
That they have used forbidden armaments in bombing Yemen.
Yemeni army says it has discovered large quantities of U.S.-built munitions at the positions of Saudi mercenaries while conducting clean-up operations in the provinces of Marib and Al-Bayda. Saudi Arabia and a number of its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 in order to bring for Riyadh-friendly President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi back to power. Riyadh is the largest buyer of American-made weaponry. Trump signed an arms deal worth $110 billion with Saudi Arabia in May 2017. The Saudi military aggression against Yemen, coupled with the naval blockade, has killed hundreds of thousands of people and plunged Yemen into what UN says the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iran has imposed fresh restrictions across the country to help stem the spread of the coronavirus. The new restrictions are imposed in the capital Tehran and other cities and towns across the nation and would last for 2 weeks. During the partial lockdown, non-essential businesses and services will be shut and cars will not be allowed to leave or enter those cities. Also, vehicles will not be allowed on the streets from 9 p.m. to 4 a.m. Violators will receive hefty fines. The Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has urged people to avoid family and social gatherings and observe health protocols and restrictions to help contain the disease. Nearly 49,000 people have died of the COVID-19 virus in Iran. The total number of infections has passed 828,000. Meanwhile, the novel coronavirus continues to spread across Europe, with several countries on the continent reporting record number of daily infections. Russia has reported nearly 25,000 infections and 467 deaths in 24 hours. Authorities say that more than 7,000 new cases were reported in the capital, Moscow. The new cases bring Russia's total tally to more than 2 million. Ukraine has also confirmed over 14,500 new cases. That is the country's highest daily infections on record. Germany's tally also shows nearly 23,000 new infections and 254 related deaths. The number of coronavirus infections in Europe has surpassed 12 million, accounting for a quarter of reported cases globally. More Republicans are putting pressure on U.S. President Donald Trump to start the transition process to Joe Biden, projected winner of the November 3rd presidential election. Several Republicans in Congress voiced doubts over Trump's claim of fraudulent voting. Michigan Representative Fred Upton said that he has seen no evidence of voting irregularities that would change Biden's lead over Trump in that state. The Utah Senator Mitt Romney wrote on Twitter that Trump had failed to make a plausible case of widespread election fraud. Senator Lamar Alexander said that Biden has a very good chance of becoming the next president. Maine Senator Susan Collins noted Biden should receive the briefings, office space, and access to government resources that he needs to be ready to govern on Inauguration Day. Different U.S. cities have faced unprecedented demand for food aid amid new coronavirus-related lockdowns. In the city of Chicago, thousands of families in low-income areas have now been turning to food handouts. Volunteers say that they have provided food to a large number of people in neighborhoods hardest hit by COVID-19. Many in those areas have been laid off from work amid the pandemic. Officials in Los Angeles have also warned of a huge spike in food demand since the start of the pandemic.
Pre-pandemic, we measure things in pounds, and we were distributing about 1.5 million pounds every week in and out of our distribution centers. And now we're running at 4 million pounds a week coming in and out of our distribution centers here in South LA and Commerce. And that's 145% increase in volume.
Officials said the coronavirus outbreak has put a lot of pressure on food banks across the U.S., especially ahead of the winter holiday season. They refer to record low lockdown-related unemployment rates as the main reason behind the increasing need for food assistance. They also warned of continued high food demand in the next year due to economic impacts of the pandemic. Another weekly protest in the Chilean capital has turned violent, with police using force against young demonstrators demanding President Sebastián Piñera's resignation. Officers in riot gear fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse an angry mob in central Santiago. At some points, police aimed the cannon directly at the protesters, releasing a jet of water on them at close range. The demonstrators in return made bonfires as barricades to throw rocks and Molotov cocktails. They called for the release of hundreds of people arrested in the course of their campaign that started more than a year ago. The movement that erupted over the price hike of transport has left some 30 people dead and thousands injured. However, it led to a successful referendum for constitutional changes last month. An internal report by the Australian military into the conduct of its special forces in Afghanistan has caused shock and outrage. Ample evidence of war crimes has piled pressure on the Australian military and the government.
The Australian military is under fire following the release of a damning report this week that has found credible evidence of war crimes in Afghanistan. The long-awaited report, based on a four-year inquiry, has found evidence that Australian special forces killed dozens of Afghan prisoners, farmers, or other civilians. The findings of the inquiry carried out by the Australian Defence Force reveal a twisted and extreme warrior culture among the elite of the Australian Armed Forces who were deployed to Afghanistan. The commandos were supposed to fight militants thousands of kilometers away from Australia, but many of them now stand accused of engaging in a methodical campaign to kill unarmed Afghans and conceal it. In one instance, the inquiry has found evidence that platoon commanders told junior soldiers to get their first kill by shooting prisoners. An academic who carried out the initial research into the atrocities believes that they were, quote, deliberate, repeated, and targeted war crimes.
It's really shocking to hear that the Australian forces were asked to execute prisoners and leave weapons next to them to justify the killing. This is far from being the objective of the NATO and multinational forces in Afghanistan that initially said it is fighting Al-Qaeda. What these forces are doing is they are really enjoying the killing of the Afghani people and also their prisoners.
The inquiry findings show that some of the soldiers who are accused of committing these war crimes are still serving in the Australian military. The report has been highly redacted, and many details of the atrocities remain unknown. But its authors have admitted that they probably failed to uncover all crimes committed during the period of time under investigation. They have recommended a mechanism to collect and assess further allegations of atrocities in Afghanistan. The findings are deeply embarrassing for the Australian government, which is a vociferous critic of rights abuses around the world. The government initially tried to suppress whistleblowers and local media that had tried to bring the alleged war crimes to public attention.
The Internal Military Report has found evidence that shows Australian elite forces killed 39 Afghan civilians between the years 2009 and 2013. The Australian military has admitted that none of the killings were committed during the heat of the battle. The few details of the alleged war crimes that have been published are shocking. Many believe that the damning document is a rare admission of war crimes during a U.S.-led war. Australia deployed forces to Afghanistan in 2002 as part of the U.S.-led campaign and still has 1,500 troops there. The U.S. military itself is also being investigated by the International Criminal Court for possible war crimes in Afghanistan.
Australian authorities tried hard to keep a lid on this story when it first emerged in 2017. That year, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation published shocking allegations of unlawful killings of unarmed Afghans, including children, based on leaked military documents. The Australian Federal Police raided the office of the national broadcaster and tried in vain to prosecute the journalists who blew the whistle on the killings. The story now seems to have turned into a major scandal. The latest findings are a painful legacy of America's longest war. The U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in October 2001 has resulted in nearly two decades of war. A very large number of Afghan civilians, including children, have lost their lives in American and U.S.-led airstrikes and operations. The U.S.-led military campaign has failed to wipe out militancy. It instead devastated Afghanistan and has left the country grappling with an endless list of problems. The United States itself is being investigated for possible war crimes in Afghanistan. The ICC probe began earlier this year after a preliminary report found reasons to believe war crimes had been committed during the war. U.S. President Donald Trump, who was infuriated by the investigation, imposed sanctions on the court. His decision drew worldwide condemnation. Observers believe that the U.S. must have a lot to worry about as the International Criminal Court investigates its actions during the war in Afghanistan.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on November 3rd, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference on the occasion of the birthday anniversaries of the Holy Prophet of Islam and Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, greetings be upon them, and which coincides this year with the National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance and Unity Week. Arrogance utilizes science and technology to exercise its taghuti power.
Pharaoh used to say, "Does not the dominion of Egypt belong to me?" The Holy Quran, chapter 43, verse 51. Very well, he could do whatever he wished in the dominion of Egypt. However, today, the U.S., which is like Pharaoh in those days, not satisfied with the country of the United States, he does not say, "Does not the dominion of Egypt belong to me?" Rather, he embarks on transgressing against other countries. He wages wars, occupies countries, and sets up military bases there. Today, things are like this. What global taghuts do by utilizing human science and technology, resulting in discrimination, inequality, and warmongering, is more serious than ever. The Holy Prophet really grieves him that you should perish. The blessed soul of the Holy Prophet really suffers from humanity's pain in the present time. He is anxious for humanity to achieve bliss, and he wishes to guide humanity. Like a gentle father, in the true sense of the word, he wants humanity to achieve bliss, to be directed to the straight path, and to achieve an end that will be good for it.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, my Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
There is a point in this holy ayah. It exists at the end of Surah Al-Bara'ah, a surah of war, of expressing one's hatred of the kuffar, and of commanding people to fight and the like. However, at the end of the surah, God says, it grieves him that you should perish. As we said, this is addressed to the entire humanity. One can derive an important point from this ayah. The ayahs preceding this one do not address ignorant non-Muslims. Rather, they address the leaders of kuffar and the chiefs of arrogance. They address the apparatus of power that has dominated the fate of human societies.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
Africa Today.
Thousands of African refugees and illegal migrants fleeing war, poverty, and persecution are dying while others face harrowing abuse in their attempts to reach Europe's Mediterranean coast. Many risk their lives in this journey fraught with dangers. One of the migrants speaks about his journey after arriving in Europe.
Une situation catastrophique nous a poussé de venir. Même il y a des gens qui meurent dans la route. Beaucoup. Il y a des accidents, tout. Il y a là-bas. C'est dur maintenant.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today. In our show today, we are analyzing some of the reasons why African migrants put their lives in danger in desperate journeys across the Mediterranean to Europe. We shall also focus on the recent elections in Seychelles, where an opposition candidate was elected as president for the first time since 1977.
Hereby declare Mr. Wavell John Charles Rankalawan as the elected candidate for the presidential election.
Stay tuned till the end of our show and keep your comments coming as you watch.
Dangerous journey to Europe. Thousands of refugees and migrants are dying, while many are suffering extreme human rights abuses on irregular journeys from Africa to Europe through the Mediterranean Sea. A recent report released by UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency, and the Mixed Migration Center, titled On This Journey, No One Cares If You Live or Die, details are provided on how most migrants suffer in the journey to Europe. Despite the risks, many continue to take this dangerous journey, saying they have no choice. According to the Missing Migrants Project of the International Organization of Migration, so far in 2020, more than 200 migrants have drowned, and over 280 others went missing while trying to cross the Mediterranean to Europe. Another 9,800 migrants were returned to Libya. This North African country has emerged as the dominant transit point for migrants hoping to get to Europe from Africa.
Libya has been in chaos since 2011 when a popular uprising and a NATO military intervention led to the ouster of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Now for more on this, we are joined by Mustafa Traore, an academic, political analyst, and founder of AnOpenEye.org. Thanks a lot, Mr. Traore, and good to have you in our show today. Now, despite being aware that they are taking a journey fraught with risks and possible death. African migrants attempt to cross the Mediterranean and enter Europe. Now, what's your take on this?
If you've got migration from Africa to the West today, it's mainly because there are some issues in the African continent. So there is misery caused by different things, and this is, I think, what we should tackle. So which means that if people are moving just because they prefer to live to some other places, this is fine. But when they are forced to leave their home land, this is where you've got a problem.
Mustafa Traore, African Affairs Analyst, thanks for that.
Most of the African countries whose citizens are escaping to Europe are rich in natural resources, including oil, gas, and minerals such as gold and uranium. However, these natural resources are being plundered by Western multinationals colluding with corrupt state officials in Africa. This looting by Western multinationals leaves many Africans poor, and for many, migration to Europe is the only option left to make it in life.
Last year, Italian Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio accused France of continuing the colonial exploitation of Africa and causing people to migrate from the continent. Let's take a listen.
Ci sono decine di stati africani.
There are dozens of African countries where France is printing a currency of its own, the franc of the colonies. And with that currency, French debt is financed. If France didn't have African colonies, which it's impoverishing, it would be the 15th world economic power.
Many of these illegal migrants crossing the Mediterranean are from African countries that continue to suffer economic exploitation by former European colonial powers. Now, are these powers to blame for this crisis?
The reason why Africans are going and migrating, trying to leave the continent, you've got to blame some of the European countries for what is happening. It is neocolonialism that put Africa in a certain situation of misery so that the people there have no other choice than leave the continent. So, and if you look at some of the organizations also, you've got in the African continent like ECOWAS, this is just a French organization. This is just an organization to better control some countries in West Africa.
Thanks for that, and stay tuned for more.
The 2011 U.S.-led NATO intervention in Libya against the dictator Muammar al-Gaddafi was a complete failure. The country descended into chaos and has never seen peace since then. Before the NATO military intervention, Libya was a prime destination for migrants within Africa. The country's oil wealth propelled a strong economy and plentiful jobs. Now Libya is a dangerous transit point for illegal migrants going to Europe. A spokesman for the United Nations High Commission for Refugees explains here why Libya and other sub-Saharan African countries are preferred by human traffickers.
The routes through North and sub-Saharan Africa are very, very complex, but typically it's where the smugglers and traffickers are able to carry out their actions with impunity. It's in places that are beset by conflict. It's in places where states often no longer have strong rule of law. They're not able to hold people, the smugglers and traffickers, accountable. And the human trafficking is just one aspect of this.
Libya is now the major North African point of transit used by illegal immigrants after a NATO military intervention that hijacked a popular revolution. Is Europe facing a crisis of its own making?
Definitely, it is. It is. But I'm not going to be concerned about what France is experiencing today. I'm more looking at the African continent and how people are suffering. What this experience tells us is that Gaddafi was a better solution. When he was in power, there were no questions of terrorists in Libya, and he warned the West about what was going to happen. He was not listened to, and now you've got Africans who used to live in very good conditions in Libya before the war that was initiated by the West and by France, and now they are just used as slaves.
African migrants faced a dangerous trek through the Sahara Desert and a precarious voyage across the Mediterranean. But when they arrive in Europe, most of them face a life full of hardships and abuses they never imagined. According to a report by the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Forms of Slavery, migrant farm workers in parts of southern Italy are enduring extreme levels of labor exploitation and coercion and inhumane working conditions. An abused immigrant worker elaborates here on his suffering.
A lot of us are living in abandoned houses where there are no toilets, no electricity, no water. Let's not talk about it. I lived in a house without electricity for 6 months. It was a shack. It was in the winter. Many people are living in these conditions.
African migrants in Europe now face human rights violations and discrimination. Now, what does this say of European countries which claim to champion for human rights?
When you had the French Revolution, and after the French Revolution, you still had slavery in the African continent, in the West Indies, and you had colonialism with forced labor. So which means this revolution you are talking about, this was for the white man and not for the dark or the black men. So this is something we've got to understand. Same thing in the United States. Okay, this was the free world in the first half of the 20th century, but black people could not vote in some states. So in fact, when white people speak of freedom and human rights, it is for them, not for the others.
Thanks for that, Mr. Traore.
Many analysts believe African countries need to pursue growth strategies that will create good jobs and incomes for all the youth, while stopping the pillaging of the continent's resources by multinationals. Ghanaian President Nana Akufo-Addo says African nations have a responsibility to help create opportunities for their citizens at home to prevent the exodus of young Africans to Europe.
It is our responsibility to create conditions that will allow our young people to be able to live lives of dignity and fulfillment in their places of origin. That's what leadership is to be focused upon. That's what our policies should be focused upon. And for me, it's obvious that we have a responsibility to our young people.
What practical steps should be taken to prevent illegal African migrants from leaving their countries for an uncertain future in Europe?
Our African understands that coming to the West is not the solution. The solution is the liberation of the African continent, fight against these big corporations exploiting the African continent and not giving back to the people in Africa. This is the solution. The leaders as well, you've got to fight against all the leaders that are puppets of the West, working for the West and not for the Africans. So this is what I think is the solution. Education through social media, informing them, supporting them in their fights, and also fighting through lobbies the governments that are not working for the Africans. Okay, because we all know everyone loves Africa, but without the Africans. And all Africans have to be aware of that. Unity among the different African states, be it North Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, we have to be united and work together and fight.
African penguin numbers are dwindling, but researchers think they may have found a solution. They're trying to make a new breeding colony. A team planned to release scores of orphaned hand-reared penguin chicks at South Africa's Western Cape De Hoop Nature Reserve in the hope of saving them from extinction. Since January last year, they have deployed dummy penguins that emit the bird's distinctive call to try and entice them to De Hoop. Success so far has been hit and miss, but researcher Christina Hagen says they remain optimistic. There was once over a million penguins here in South Africa back in the 1920s. Now there's only around 13,000. The researchers now plan to release around 50 juvenile birds each year over several years, starting early next year, to try and establish the colony. Using decoys is a more unusual strategy. Hagen says hand-reared chicks are usually released into existing colonies, but De Hoop has good fishing waters and it was settled briefly by penguins in the mid-2000s, until they deserted it again after leopards started hunting them.
From other studies, the decoys don't even have to be super realistic. They can just be the right shape and colour and the birds respond to them into thinking they were real.
Dwindling African penguin numbers are attributed largely to depleting fish stocks and worsened by climate change. Their eggs have also been harvested for human consumption.
Opposition's victory in Seychelles elections.
An opposition candidate won the Seychelles presidential election in October, marking the first opposition victory since the Indian Ocean archipelago's independence from Britain more than four decades ago. Wavell Ramakalawan defeated President Danny Faure by 54.9% to 43.5%. This is how his victory was declared by the head of the Electoral Commission.
I declare Mr. Wavell John Charles Ramakalawan as the elected candidate for the presidential election.
In his first comments since winning, Mr. Ramakalawan was conciliatory and emphasized that the country was the ultimate winner.
In these elections, there were no losers, there were no winners. Our country was given the opportunity to come out as the ultimate winner.
Ramakalawan, a former Anglican priest, defeated Faure after three decades of unsuccessful runs for the presidency of the East African nation, an Indian Ocean archipelago famed for its natural beauty and rare wildlife. Now, to discuss more on the unprecedented and historic victory of the opposition in the recent elections in Seychelles, we have contacted Julius Mbaluto, an African affairs analyst. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Mbaluto. Now, what triggered the opposition victory in Seychelles against a party that has been in power for 44 years?
Despite the fact that Seychelles is one country with the highest GDP in Africa, poverty still remained a very key issue, and also the gap between the rich and the poor carried on widening. And it's only a way of saying that, yes, people had enough, especially the voters, and they had to vote perhaps a system that is going to be serving them. And that also explains why they chose as their president a priest. Man who has been a preacher, talking about the values in a person and ethics. Most of the time, we have seen the society wherever we are tending to think, religious people tend to come up with better ethics. They tend to come up with compassion for the masses.
Ramakalawan's campaign was largely based on a pledge to hike the minimum wage after COVID-19 stifled the tourism-dependent economy. In an interview before the elections, Faure admitted that the first 6 months of the COVID-19 pandemic were the toughest in his presidency.
Well, what I can say, the last 6 months has been the toughest 6 months of my presidency. And let me be clear here. The seat of the presidency is not an easy seat.
Seychelles relies heavily on tourism, which collapsed following the COVID-19 pandemic. Was this a factor in the victory by the country's opposition party?
Yes, COVID-19 has messed the economy of Seychelles. It just brought it almost down to its knees, because when you see the amount of people who travel in Seychelles, an estimate of about 350,000 in a year. It's a lot of people. And seeing, you know, what has been happening throughout 2020, inability of people to even make just a flight, not even to go and become a tourist, it's been a nightmare. And yes, there definitely, again, I would say probably the voting was also instructed by what was going on. And again, I think people were thinking, let's elect someone who will be more capable to deal with our problem, especially to rebuild the economy after the impact, you know, from COVID-19 and beyond.
According to the World Bank, Seychelles has the highest gross domestic product, GDP, per capita in Africa at nearly $17 billion in 2019. But inequality is significant, placing the prospect of continued shared prosperity in tighter focus. This inequality has come with the problem of drug addiction. This Indian Ocean archipelago suffers from the highest rate of heroin abuse in the world. Policymakers are now putting measures in place to tackle the growing problem.
When we did the survey in 2011, and we found out that we had around 1,200 youths using heroin, we should have acted then, but we didn't. What we did, we increased the sentences. The major problem is for many, many, many years, the approach has been a punitive one.
The economy of Seychelles is still controlled by people of European descent, while locals are faced with many problems such as drug addiction and poverty. What is the reason for these inequalities?
A lot of investors, especially in the audio industry, always, most of them are Europeans, and they come and they invest a lot. But their issue is to just maximize profit, minimizing, you know, the cost. And therefore, you find a situation whereby you will always have that inequality, whereby despite Seychelles having a very wonderful, very, very important and wonderful economy, you know, how it looks, you still find that we still have inequality. We still find Seychelles people talking about having that narrative of $1 a day kind of way lifestyle.
A variety of ethnic groups can be found in the cultural melting pot of the Seychelles, and each has left its own mark on the country's vibrant and peaceful society. Now, what needs to be done to bridge the gap between the rich and the poor in the Seychelles so that all can feel they are part of the country's unique culture and geographical location?
The country of Seychelles has got enough. The question is, what is the government going to do to make sure there is equality, there is justice, there is fairness, and also those who are investing, are they paying people living wage, or are they just going to make money at the expense of poor people and perpetrating poverty? We should not be talking about poverty in a country like Seychelles, because it's got enough resources at its own disposal to make sure every citizen lives proudly as a Seychellian and is proud to belong to the country. And why? Because they have enough, and they have enough to live on, and they even have enough to share.
Well, Julius Banluto there believes that if the government in the Seychelles takes serious steps to end inequality, then poverty will be eliminated in these pristine Indian Ocean islands. Well, that brings us to the end of our show, which also focused on the increasing problem of young, desperate Africans risking their lives in a dangerous journey to Europe due to lack of opportunities in Africa. On behalf of the entire African Today team, take care and goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. In this program, we're going to look at some principles of upbringing children so that the audience gets a detailed description of the matter concerning how to raise the children Islamically. The answers are mostly based upon the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Ray Shahri. We have in our studio guest speaker Sister Salma Khalfan, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program, dear Sister Khalfan.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me over.
Yeah, well. So, Sister Khalfan, in the previous episode, we talked about the psychological theories behind playing in the growth of a child. Would you like to enlighten the audience more on this question?
Yes, I would like to just remind our audience some things that were left out in the previous episode that I think it's very necessary for them to know.
Yes.
Is that, especially when you blend it with the, what it, the Islam says about blame.
Yes,
you know?
True.
So all these theories were like falsified in one way or the other because it doesn't explain the holistic approach of why playing is so necessary for the growth of a child, especially when you look at Islam, you know, why it emphasizes leave them free for 7 years to play, leave them to play, play with them, be a, like a child when you're playing with them, and all these theories. So some of these theories were like the theory of extra power, the theory of removing tension, the theory of evolving renewal, and the theory of pre-exercise. And I just want to, you know, point out basically what these theories talk about. The theory of extra power when, you know, the power is accumulated so much that it needs to be let out.
True, yes.
So that's not the only thing, because sometimes children, they have let out all their power, but yet they feel like playing games, you know. So it doesn't explain everything of it. Quiet games, games that don't involve letting out of energy, you know, like reading is also a game, solving a puzzle is also a game. So these kind of things don't explain the theory of extra power. As far as the theory for removing tension is concerned, here it you know, it said that the when the bodily power appears to have reached the lowest level, and that's the time a person, a child needs to play. It's the lowest level of bodily energy. This is the opposite as the
So
the
basically
extra power.
You're mentioning the reasons as to why Islam is emphasizing so much on the kids playing.
Yeah, but this is just one aspect that they're looking at, the different kinds of theories, that is the psychological aspect.
Okay.
I want to stress, inshallah, after this, more about why Islam stresses so much on playing, disregarding these kind of theories.
All right.
Or
okay.
maybe blending them all together.
All right.
Okay, not just sufficing one of them. That's not the only reason why children like to play. Like removing of tension. It doesn't explain when a child wakes up in the morning, has removed all his tension at night by sleeping, having a good, you know, sleep, a sound sleep, and then he feels like playing. So he doesn't have any energy as such, but he feels like
playing,
right? So that even doesn't explain the removal of tension. As far as the theory of evolving renewal is concerned, is, you know, they copy the ancestors of how they were, you know, like playing, and mm-hmm. they repeat that in the same manner. And it explains a bit as to how the parents teach the child to go about playing. Okay. But it's not the only thing, because as times go by, different kinds of play evolve.
Okay.
You know, there are new ideas that come about. Uh-huh. And then they learn from even outside society, their friends, their playmates, different kinds of games. So it's not just the fact that the ancestors used to perform these kind of games to probably, you know, teach them in future life okay. how to be and how to go about, you know, playing and everything. It's not just that. It's more to it. Okay. There are different kinds of games that evolve in every generation. So it's just not the evolving of renewal. Otherwise, you know, they would do, always they would pass their time by hunting, boating, fishing and all these things. True. Whereas we don't see that happening, yeah. you know.
Yes.
And then also the attitude of pre-exercise is that the content of playing is formed by activities that the child must have in the maturity period and adult life. But it's not like that, of okay. course. Although this theory points out to the function of playing in the socializing of a child that was not mentioned in the former theories, but it cannot define the childish behavior of a child, like, for example, imitating some animalistic noises or things like that. So it's not like, you know, only these, the games are introduced that will help him in the maturity level.
Okay. No,
it's just like any kind of game. You know, that is played, mm-hmm. but of course it is beneficial for the child, and it gives him happiness.
Right.
It gives him that freedom.
So, Sister Salma Khalfan, let's just take a break and we'll be back. Dear listeners, stay tuned and don't go away. We'll be back soon.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Welcome back. This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Sister Khalfan,
as far as Islam is concerned, it motivates that the child, you know, should be encouraged his freedom. Why is because of very many importances laid out.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the physical importance. The physical importance is the activities for the growth of the child's muscles, giving exercises to different parts of the body, mm-hmm. which is of very much high importance and